For parents and teachers across the country, the tagline of back to school, back to reality has never evoked such a mixed array of different emotions. South Africa closed all its schools in March as part of the lockdown measures designed to curb the pandemic. And late last week, the Department of Basic Education announced a plan for the gradual reopening of schools. Now, the announcement has obviously brought home the fact that many schools are not in a condition to welcome pupils back in a way that ensures their health and safety. And for many, this will mean that they can't return to their classrooms with long-term consequences for the country. These would include having to shift the school-going age for children and losing an entire cohort of university entrants. Now, the impact of the changes being forced by COVID-19 were best summed up by the Minister of Basic Education, Angie Motshekga, when she said that the virus has forced us to re-engineer the basic education system. To talk about how we do this, to talk about how we re-engineer and the current state of readiness, and to hopefully debate constructively how, in fact, we use this opportunity to sort out some of these legacy issues in basic education. It's a great pleasure to welcome our Zoom room today. Firstly, we've got Olani Fakude, who is the Secretariat Officer of the South African Democratic Teachers Union, SATU, Professor Elizabeth or LB Henning, Director for the Centre for Education Practice Research at UJ, Mary Metcalf, a very well-known education expert and former Gauteng MEC for Education, and Nonedo Madube-Dube, General Secretary of Equal Education. Olani, kick us off here. SATU has opposed schools reopening until certain concerns were addressed. Just firstly, what are your primary concerns?
We would recall, Michael, that SATU, and not just SATU, by the way, but all the other teacher unions as well, in the Education Labour Relations Council, set on the table about 14 minimum conditions, which we felt that the Department of Basic Education must meet as minimum requirements before we can even talk about going to the school. And those minimum requirements, primarily, Michael, they are also based on the World Health Organization's regulations that have been stipulated. They're also based on the regulations by the Department of Labor as well, that are very clear as to what conditions must be met before a public space like a school can be occupied. And this includes, not limited to, Michael, the deep cleaning, sanitizing, and fumigation of the schools. It includes the delivery of the minimum package of the protective wear for education workers and also for the learners as well. And it includes a number of other areas, Michael, which we are hoping, by the way, that we'll still get clarity on, such as the issue around comorbidities, or the inherent underlying conditions that education workers might have. We still need clarity on those. Clear a kind of an HR a plan as to how we deal with substitute teachers amongst the other areas. So the unions, which is organized labor, sat down with the Department of Basic Education, and we set these minimum conditions. And we said, Michael, that our biggest concern is the safety, is the health of education workers and awareness, and we are not going to compromise on that.
So quite clearly, you've set out those 14 measures. Just to stay with you for 1 second longer, we've got the Basic Education Minister going around the country, doing some inspections, having a look to see whether or not those measures have indeed been put in place. From the samples and surveys you've done amongst your members and at the schools where your members work, how prepared are we? Where are the glaring gaps at the moment?
Well, I can tell you without any fear of contradiction, Michael, that a number of surveys that we've conducted, we started with a baseline survey first, which showed that there's a lot of historical and deep-seated challenges. For instance, Michael, we're still talking about no less than 3,700 schools that needed basic sanitation infrastructure, even before you could talk about a COVID hygiene package. And there's a number of gaps. When we did the first survey, when we surveyed a number of principals, we found out that as of the 20th of May, they had not even received the first communication from the authorities to advise them on how to deal with this particular COVID pandemic. So there's still a lot of gaps, Michael, that are left, and there's still a lot of work that still requires to be done.
Nonedo, we know one of the biggest gaps, and I think what COVID-19 has done has magnified and accelerated the conversation around deeper inequality and structural issues that have been evident for so long. Then COVID-19 came along, and one of the biggest gaps is obviously infrastructure. And, you know, Michael Kompepe drowning in a pit latrine. gathered a lot of public media attention at the time. Then that kind of fell away a little bit. What are some of the key infrastructure gaps that you as Equal Education are concerned about? Because for so long you fought for those minimum norms and standards.
Look, I also do want to say that the members inside Equal Education are all learners, and they've been poorly consulted during this period. But I think inside our own organization and having this conversation, what's come out is that members are, well, when I say members, I mean learners, are particularly interested in going back to school, but there are fears, legitimate fears around the health implications of being back inside schools, especially for those that are inside sort of epicenters and communities that have got high density, so that's townships, and in the more sort of affluent towns of rural communities. And part of the concern around going back to school is that because of the 10 years of advocacy and struggle for the basic necessities in terms of infrastructure in their schools, they have very little hope that the Department of Basic Education and the provincial education departments are going to be able to deliver the necessary things. So the tools for screening, the PPEs, toilet facilities or sanitation facilities that aren't plain pit latrines and water security in their schools. In what the minister had used sort of supply chain language to say just-in-time delivery. So what we're doing at the moment is that we're calling principals, we're calling school districts across five provinces, namely Eastern Cape, Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, Limpopo, and the Eastern Cape, Western Cape, sorry, to get a sense of the readiness of schools on the ground. And we want to be able to use this kind of information to either inform the decisions of parents to send back their children to school or to inform the position of learners and how they respond to be back at school and are able to maybe even support some of the anxieties from their teachers. What we're picking up at the moment is that as we talk to learners about the anxieties of going back to school, teachers are exacerbating the kind of anxiety because they too are unsure of their own safety being back at school and what it means if they don't go. Teachers are talking to learners about a possibility of having to run curricula online while the phased in approach sort of being rolled out by the Departments of Basic Education. And they're really concerned. They already feel that they've lost so much of their learning time, especially those exit grades, and sit in pre-existing unequal conditions to begin with. So there's great anxiety about what going back to school means for their health, but also the ability to catch up in curricula. And so we're doing all these varying things, trying to get information from them, their own schools, to assess if the just-in-time delivery is actually going to happen, and we'll have these necessities, like Ukalani was highlighting, before schools open.
By just in time, I mean, that is fairly vague. It could be a couple of minutes before schools open, which might not be very helpful. It does sound like there are still a lot of gaps and a lot of outstanding deliveries for things like PPE, screening, testing equipment. Mary, I think the fact is that in South Africa, we have this situation where you have your so-called quintile one schools in the suburbs who generally might be better resourced or better prepared to welcome learners back on the 1st of June. And then the majority of schools are the so-called quintile two schools, where there are deep infrastructural challenges and where the bulk of the concern lies at the moment. So I think we really need to separate those two out. In the quintile two school environment, these challenges raise serious concerns for both teachers and parents and children. What advice or what is your perspective on those concerns? How concerned should they be, considering that children are, by international studies, at low risk of contracting COVID-19?
That's a red rag to a bull for me to say that children are at low risk. I think that we have to take care of every person, whether that we consider from the evidence for them to be high risk or low risk. And the question of children being considered to be low risk doesn't take into account that teachers will be the most at risk in terms of the very same stats. So opening schools is not just about learners, it's about the whole community. Now, you raised the question of inequalities in our society. Those have been covered very well by both Kalani and Nantero in terms of the fact that schools in the poorer quintiles, 1, 2 to 3, often don't have the necessary infrastructure, including the basics of water and sanitation. And I think we need to congratulate SATU and the other unions for the careful work that they're doing to monitor monitor that. So when you talk about re-engineering the system, what does COVID highlight that needs re-engineering? Firstly, that the basic inequalities that exist in terms of infrastructure have to be addressed urgently, not just to launch the reopening of schools, but so that the backlogs that we've been living with for the last 20 plus years are addressed. The other thing that needs to be re-engineered is an understanding of how the home can support the school. Now, the quintile, the wealthy quintile, sorry, I got my quintiles wrong just now. It's quintile 5 that's really the wealthy, and quintile 1, 2, and 3 that are the poorer ones. There are some families who are trying to replicate the learning environment at home. And I think many of those families have learned that it's quite unrealistic, and we can come back to that. For many families, even attempting to have continuity of learning from home, a distant dream, because they don't have resources, both in terms of any ambition to do IT-based learning. There's no devices, there's no data, there's no Wi-Fi, there's unreliable networks. But there's other components of learning at home that we're going to need to come to terms with in terms of how we support learners going forward. When I say learners going forward, we have to accept that the minister and the DG have said that schools are going to have a 50% occupancy. That means we're not going to have the same time in schools as we had expected at the beginning of the year. More learning will need to be done at home. It's not going to be IT-based in terms of computers. It's going to be based on broadcast. It's going to be based on teachers making sure that what they structure for work at home is not just the normal homework, but you're not going to be at school for 2 days or 1 day or half the day tomorrow, depending on the timetabling arrangements. This is what I would like you to do now. How does the home support that? For a child to be able to learn effectively at home, parents need to be able to create the necessary routines, create the necessary space, bring in older siblings. And the Civil Society Coalition, which Nondyebo Lead Education Group, has prepared an excellent document which should be widely distributed, both in print but at the moment on social media and other media, which helps parents think about how to plan to support their children.
We're talking about getting teachers, parents, learners ready to go back to school on the 1st of June. Professor Albie Henning, we've discussed a lot of the challenges so far. What are your thoughts on some of those challenges and a way forward through all of this?
Let me first say, Michael, that I'm not involved in any of these big surveys and in any of the bigger platforms. So most of my thinking and experience is on a smaller scale. It's mostly qualitative. And so what I can say from the kids and the teachers with whom I've had contact in whatever way, and some of it has been personal, there is great anxiety about everything that has been said. I understand how teachers feel. I'm thinking, what would I do were I now a teacher and of a certain age and I have to go back to school? I have to do it because I have to have an income. So I think we must not deny the real fear and anxiety and how it could impact. Even, say for instance, a whole grade 7 class is back at school next week, and they have a couple of teachers who teach them. Each teacher has to do catch up. Each child in that class, each young person has to do catch up. They did not, in the absence of guidance, do what one does, if you know how to go about preparing for a difficult time, namely the typical cognitive activities of recall, repeat, revise, test yourself. That's what I would, in any case, advise the people in grade 12 to do. Just go ahead and test yourself on everything that you possibly can because you have materials. But thinking of the grade 7s who may go back and their teachers, we mustn't underestimate the anxiety that underlies all of this and how difficult it is going to be to stand in front of a class, to teach using a mask, to talk to children who are wearing masks with all the communication in such a different dynamic. Just think of how you feel when you go to a supermarket. Now, this going on for a couple of hours a day. So I don't think we must underestimate that. And we must think more along, I would suggest, how can we alleviate the tensions that'll come with going back to school, if we do.
And that's why, and Nolani, to bring you in here, Satu did acknowledge the psychosocial support that was put on the table by the Department of Basic Education and how important that is as a wraparound package here. But I want to come back to the issue of targeted interventions and why I raised the issue of the different risk factors between young children and obviously older teachers and some of those who might have comorbidities, because it sounds to me like we really should be focusing a lot of our effort, attention and energy on those who are at high risk, and that really is the teachers here.
Your observations are correct, Michael. Indeed, the issues around education workers with comorbidities is quite important to us. But then once again, Michael, when we talk of a risk-adjusted approach, we also must be conscious of the fact that the very science that the minister says she relies on tells us that learners or younger ones in fact may be asymptomatic carriers. Now we've got a very deep or significant proportion of our learners, by the way, who are staying or even living with older caregivers, grandparents, and I mean that is really a deep structural issue with a lot of historical connotations to it. So what we are saying, Michael, is that there is a lot of complexities that need to be considered when one deals with issues such as the reopening of the schools, for instance. That is why what is important for us, and an emphasis, Michael, is that the spirit of consultation in good faith, and that is what we want to permanently and perpetually indicate, that it is not just good enough, for instance, for political leaders in the education space to come and utter reckless statements, really, that even cause anxiety, as we're seeing right now in KZN, for instance, when you see a minister talking and saying that, look, but teachers got paid, therefore they must be at work. What, therefore, are you saying about these professionals? So that seeks to also increase the trust deficit between the leadership and between ourselves as education workers as well. So what is important, Michael, is consultation and transparency. It is absolutely important for us as a union.
Nolani, to this point, has that conversation been happening in good faith, or is that for you starting to break down?
Absolutely not. We do not believe that up to this point it has been happening in good faith. In fact, we characterize it this way as such. We are saying that the Minister and the Department of Basic Education has been convening information sessions, not even consultation sessions, but information sessions, whereby we will be asked, what is it that you think are the minimum requirements? But then when the ultimate decisions are made, that have got a direct impact on our work conditions, and therefore we are just informed that this is the tentative date when the schools are going to be reopening, without even considering the accuracy of the data that comes from the ground. So we believe, as organized labor, that the consultations have not necessarily been happening in good faith.
Nonqedo, I want to come back to this issue of learning at home and doing as much as we can at home. As a parent with two beautiful daughters, age 5 and 3, there's a lot of work, even at grade R level, for someone who's working from home to try and then also be a teacher. I'm in a very privileged position. I acknowledge that. I've got a sister who I can lean on quite heavily, and she's been teaching my eldest. Not many parents are in that fortunate situation. Have children been able to learn at home during this lockdown? Is that possible?
So the members that we have that are in grade 12, for example, have said, look, we're doing our best to catch up and learn. We're using WhatsApp groups that they've self-started themselves. They're finding ways to communicate with their teachers. Some of them are even visiting each other to share textbooks if they're in the same sort of neighborhood. Because there's a general anxiety about what happens to us as an exit grade. The rest of learners are just wholly saying it's difficult to learn at home. And I think the guide that Mary is mentioning is now up on the C19 People's Coalition page. It's going up on Equal Education's page as well. And we're encouraging people to put the guide up and share it as widely as possible, because there are simple tricks and techniques that siblings that are older, like you mentioned, and parents could use to just help create some structure for learners to think about learning. But on the ups, on the cross side of that is that I've also got friends, familiars, and acquaintances that have children in quintile 4 and 5 schools. And they've got set out timetables from their own schools. I was following Queen's College on Twitter the other day, for my own reasons, but they'd put up their own sort of timetable for how you stagger the work school day. And there's just a vast discrepancy, you know, or difference in how people are coming to learning because of those conditions. And like what Colin was saying, the socioeconomic conditions of our home environments are also playing quite a huge role. So learners that were inside the more rural parts of provinces, we had a Facebook Live a week and a bit ago, and they were mostly just going, look, the amount of housework we have to do is just like unprecedented. And there's no way to be able to juggle schoolwork and homework. So this is when I thought it's actually just necessary that we open up schools and think about how learners can inform the type of ways that they'd also like to feel safe and cared for, I think, inside the learning sort of environment. And when you also think about conversations had with institutions or organizations like Rape Crisis, where they say 40% of the cases that have come in to date have been from children, I'm starting to really worry about what it means for this generation of young people to be at home for such an extended period of time, given that there aren't structures, tools, resources, capacity for caregivers to guard and nourish and create conditions of like critical thinking and learning for learners. And so when we do eventually come back, if it isn't on the 1st of June, or if the staggered or rephrasing approach falls apart, as a result of lack of consultation, insecurity, distrust, I think teachers, the education system is going to have a huge sort of challenge, bigger than what we have now on their hands. So I'm sitting optimistically hoping that through our monitoring work and through what the departments are able to do and put up this formal communication, parents can start feeling like they can have some handle of the situation. And civil society activity, like this guide, for example, are going to go a long way in facilitating and assisting that process.
And I think, Mary, very valid and real concerns that have been raised so far in the panel. As we reach the end of this time, we can ill afford for this process to now fall apart at the 11th hour. What is your hope from here?
For me, the most urgent thing is for the minister, together with the provincial leadership, to sit down at the table with the unions and the school governing bodies. I think that needs to be chaired by somebody or a group that all of the parties have confidence in, so that there can be a genuine conversation identifying the challenges and together finding solutions to those challenges. Once we have government, the teacher leaders and the teacher unions and the school governing bodies speaking the same language to the public, we can start building the confidence that Nontedo has spoken about, that the learners need, and the certainty about what to do as families and learners to be ready to go back to school, as Albie has spoken about. We need to call for that conversation, not a negotiation, not an adversarial relationship, but a shared commitment to finding solutions to what at the moment are major challenges to opening schools.
As we can see, Kolani, just to give you the last word on that suggestion, very prudent and pragmatic suggestion by Mary Metcalf, is that conversation happening between yourselves as SATU and government at this stage to sit down around the table and have this conversation? And if it isn't, what do you see happening on the 1st of June?
Well, we are hoping that conversation will happen, Michael. As we would have said earlier, and again, Mary is correct, that what is important here is about how we take everyone on board. Remember, Michael, education is a societal issue. And as a union, we have always involved that. But it is not just about the learner and the teacher in the school environment, but it is a whole entire systemic issue, and it must be dealt in that way. So we're saying that it is a societal issue, that's how it must be dealt with. Now, as to what then will happen on Monday, but then firstly, Michael, let me respond to your earlier question. Is the conversation happening? It is happening, but it is happening, unfortunately, in what we classify as such, not necessarily in good faith. Like I said, it's not necessarily consultation, but it's information sessions. So on Monday, Michael, to answer you more directly, is that as a union, we are very clear, is that no learner should be left behind. So we are saying that if one school, if one province is not ready, then the system is not ready, because anything else that you are going to do, you are going to be deepening the inequalities that already characterize the value chain of the education system. So we are saying as a union that if one province is not ready, then the system is not ready. So the mandate part of it still remains a bit impractical. It's not pragmatic. It's unrealistic. And these are some of the issues, really, Michael, that sort of really degenerate the trust levels that we even have on our leaders.
Thank you all very much. Very complex and multifaceted societal issue, as Molani said, and quite clearly we need to start seeing a little bit more leadership from our political leaders in particular. That was Molani Fokude, who is the spokesperson for SATU. We had Mary Metcalf, education expert and a former Gauteng MEC for education. Albie Henning, director for the Center for Education at UJ. And Nqedo Madube Dube, who is the general secretary of Equal Education. Obviously, this is an important breaking issue, and hopefully we can see some resolution before the weekend.